originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
Basalt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is, of course, the show trainers listen to, and we are happy to have you listening tonight on Sirius 219 XM Channel 201, and everyone tuning in worldwide on our website through horseracingradio.net. Happy to have you with us for another brand new edition of Trainer Talk here tonight. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, alongside my usual entry mate. He is the pontiff of the Pick Four, Jude Feld, and we are with you in our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios. And pontiff, looking forward to another brand new program here tonight.
Yeah, I'm so glad we are having this trainer on. He's really had a great run this year, and he's one of my favorites, has been since the big brown days, not to give anything away.
It has a fascinating story as well. I mean, this program is about, you know, people's lives and how they got started and people who helped them along the way. And we will get into those types of storylines. But oftentimes we run into a trainer like tonight's guest who has had several highs and several lows in both their personal life and their professional career. And looking forward to hearing the story here tonight.
Yeah, he's got a great story. And I can't wait to get to it.
Well, without further ado, let's do that. He is a 67-year-old native of New York. He grew up in Flushing, Queens area, began training in the early to mid 1970s. He has saddled 378 winners with more than $14.5 million in purse earnings. He is trainer Patrick Reynolds, who is with us tonight on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Patrick, welcome to the show, my friend.
Thank you, Mike. Hi, Jude.
Hey.
Looking forward to having you on board. Looking forward to hearing that story. And, you know, Pat, as we often do, we kind of start at the beginning and we go back to the early days when you were just kind of growing up in New York and maybe being around horses for the first time. What, take us back to how it all got started for you.
Well, you guys got me a little intimidated now with the Baron and the Pontiff. So I don't, you know.
Means nothing.
But I was going to St. John's University in, 69, in 1970. And, you know, the Vietnam War was a factor then and all of that. And I was actually walking horses in the morning and going to school in the afternoon. And sometimes I was waiting tables at night and, you know, I worked for Rokeby Stables as a hot walker early on. You know, I caught the bug and, you know, bought a racing form every day. And they used to call me Handicapping Jack, you know, and all that. So, you know, that's where I learned the fundamentals of, you know, Paul Mellon Stable and Elliot Birch was the head trainer back then. So that was a nice introduction.
Were you one of those kids that had your racing form underneath your textbook in class?
Exactly.
Did you ever get caught?
Yeah, that was pretty much what I was doing.
It's really one of those things you just can't get away from when you get into it and you're young and you think it's an easy game sometimes, but you know, you got to get the scratches. You got all those things you got to do in the morning, and school oftentimes gets in the way.
Yeah, well, after a couple of years, I made a decision that I was going to, you know, run away and join the circus. So I took to the track full time. You know, and you know, school was okay. I stayed there 2 years, and you know, I just decided I was going to make a run at it. My uncle had been a trainer, and you know, at the time, like you know, you said, it looked easy, you know, get an owner like Paul Mellon and start winning the United Nations Handicap and Preaknesses and all of that. But, you know, after time goes on, it's a struggle when you don't have a lot of horses, for sure.
What was the conversation like with your parents when you decided to leave school and join the circus, as you put it?
Well, what are you going to do? I mean, I wasn't like I was 14 years old anymore. My dad was a mutual clerk, so he knew the hustle of the racetrack and the allure of the track. So he wasn't surprised, really. My mother, would, of course, figured on it. I would have finished school, but I just figured I would take a run at it. And I got licensed a little bit early, and I bounced around after I left the big outfit scene, and I worked for some guys who had some cheaper horses, and then ended up getting my license at Rockingham Park in 73 and stayed there 73 and 74. So that was kind of like from one extreme to the next, with all the bad-legged horses up there. You're not breezing anybody in tandem, 5/8 and out, 3/4 and all that. And you got a lot. 50% of the horses up there had a lot of problems. They couldn't train that hard. So I did get schooled as far as leg work and, management of ailments and, old problems. So it was a good experience.
Who was the first owner to give you a shot?
I actually had a guy, my dad was a mutual clerk, and he was working with a guy that owned a pizzeria. They called him Patty Pizza. He was in Brooklyn. He had a place called Del Mar Pizzeria, a real popular place. And I would say, people would say, "Patty, how's the pizza business?" He'd say, "There's a lot of dough in it." and literally there was. It was a very, very good place. And he owned the building. He owned the pizzeria and didn't have to pay rent. So as time went on, he had a little job over there. He structured out his life really good. So he decided, he saved up some money, and he bought some horses. And, he hired me. I had about 7 or 8 horses for him, but, mostly claimers. And he partnered up with a guy named Arthur Yorks. And Arthur was a bookkeeper, so he did the books and, kept the money going. And Patty and him, they had some faith in me. We won some good races. And a lot of times we had cheaper horses, but they would come up the ladder, work hard on their legs and try to improve them. So we had a couple of seconds and thirds, like Gallant Fox Handicap. We had a horse called Hug a Tag, and he was, essentially a $15,000-$18,000 horse, but he could stay around the ground. So as he could stay around the ground, he improved, and he ran second to Michelle Compass, a good horse that John DeStefano had when he was training, and a couple other placings in those big races. So I got a little taste of running in stakes, and then then a couple of lean years here and there, some discouragement. I had to go back to work for people and whatnot. And I guess in the late 90s and I hooked up with Flatbird Stable. I got a break with a horse called Peeping Tom.
Yeah,
we took him out of a 40 claimer at the Aqueduct, the whole places, as a 3-year-old, and did a few things, castrated him because he was a little unmanageable. Slapped a set of blinkers on him, put him on the Lasix program, and he was owned by the Slough crew. He was on Karen and Mickey Taylor and Albert Finney. So Albert Finney had to ever play any angry man parts after that, he had plenty of preparation. Peeping Tom earned $1.4 million in purses. It was my first stake winner. He won the General George over there in Maryland at Laurel, and then he followed that up with that was a Grade Two. And he followed it up by the Palmanok, and then he did win the Grade One Carter Handicap in New York the same day that Fusiachi Pegasus got his prep for the Kentucky Derby. So it was kind of an eventful day. The blacksmiths were over there working on both horses at the same time. They both had those innovative glue-on shoes on at the time. They were some of the first stake horses that ever wore the glue-on shoes. So that was a good experience. He was a real good horse. I think I ran him 40 times, and he ran 2,100 or better buyers in his career.
Wow.
And he had some problems, but he ran through them.
What was it that caught your eye with Peeping Tom when you claimed him for the $40,000?
I'd like like a lot of guys, I'd like to tell a story and all of that about the nick and the pedigree and the confirmation. But being a claiming trainer, when you drop a slip for a $40,000 horse, you think to yourself, can he win for a quarter? You know, can I get this owner out for $25,000? And I looked at him, and he didn't look like he was hurting anywhere in any specific areas. I said, I can get this guy out. You know, he can win for a quarter. So everything else was icing on the cake. And you just don't, you know, you don't know you're gonna make a quantum leap with a claiming horse up into the grade one area. But he just didn't like to train, but he loved to run. He just kept getting better and better and better. And he found a home, you know, we kind of understood one another. In the summertime, we used to stop training him and put him out in the paddock with mud in there, let him walk around in the mud, cool his feet out for the summer. He would, in the heat, he just couldn't stand the heat. The day that he won the General George, it was about 30 in the morning, and then the radio came on and said, it's because the temperature will drop severely by this afternoon. And when it dropped 10 degrees, he got happier and happier and happier. He ran 7/8 and 120, 1/1. He beat Delaware Township, all the fastest horses on the East Coast. And I think McAnally shipped one in, or McAnally or the other guy, the other good trainer out there. The guy that had all those good fillings, and Peep and Tom just smoked everybody. He ran by him. He might have beat anybody that day, and pulled himself up 40 yards after the wire and was outside on the outside fence licking the outside rail. So he was really a quirky horse, but he could, when he wanted to, he could run. You know, $1.4 million for a sprinter, that's pretty good.
Yeah, especially in those days. He sounds kind of cool.
Yeah, no, it was
cool.
Disco Rico was in there. It was a jam-packed full of good horses, and he just ran away from everybody. And then he continued on, and I guess that caught the eye of a couple owners over here. Paul Pomper contacted me, or I contacted him, or whatever. And, he bought me a lot of nice horses. He was just coming into the business, you know, higher profile than he'd been. And, he was spending, $250,000, $300,000 a horse and claiming high-profile horses. His idea was on quality and not quantity. So we filled up the barn with some nice horses, and had one in Florida that I thought was going to develop into the next stake horse. We had claimed him. And he ended up winning the first time we ran him in a 75 claim, and we claimed him for 6250. He won a 75. Brokers made him for 75,000 at Gulfstream. He must have fought five horses in the race and hung on one by a head. And after the race was over, I went down there thinking I had a champion on my hands. You know, the horse that was going to go up the ladder anyhow. And next thing I know, he was reclaimed by the guy that had him. And, you know, he never really developed. But, you know, in my mind, that stuck. So a month later, when the owner told me there was a half-brother to him in the sale, I got very interested. He was in a two-year-old training sale, I think, in Kentucky, and he bought Big Brown. He bought Big Brown for $190,000 out of that sale. And he sent him right to me, and, I got him ready and put the finishing touches on him over here at Saratoga. That was, I think, 2007. And, 2007, he broke his leg and ran away from. He looked like a BMW going down on a rail. You know, he ran on the turf course over here.
Oh, yeah, we were there. Yeah. Pat, that's one of the great stories that Jude and I like to tell. We were there. We were actually standing out back watching the race on a television monitor at Saratoga, and he whistled. He won that race, and Jude and I looked at each other with that look on your face that it just kind of meant, what the hell did we just see? That was right. So impressive. Yeah.
That's the cleaned up version.
Yeah. What was that? There might have been an expletive in there, too.
What the bleep was that? And
you're allowed to curse on Sirius, aren't you?
What's that?
You're allowed to curse on Sirius,
aren't you? Yeah, we try to keep it a family show. But.
Yeah, we're all gentlemen of the test. But, that was very impressive. But, you know, the same talk, but the flip side of that was by the time the owner got to the Northway, he had like seven offers come in, and I saw he knew it was going to be a dicey situation. You know, I would want to hang on to him as a trainer, but, that wasn't in the cards. He was sold shortly thereafter, and I had put him on the turf because, just in general, he was a big horse. He pounded a lot. He hit the ground pretty hard, so I put him on the grass up here, and I trained him over here in Oklahoma, and I trained him on the Oklahoma turf course as well. and he stayed sounder than he would have been. You know, as soon as he hit the hard, like Aqueduct, he was sold over there to IEAH stable, and Rick Dutrow became the trainer, and then got over to Aqueduct, and that's when the foot problem started to surface. He actually never took a bad step, you know, and just there were some indications that, you know, you're working fast on the dirt, he'd have a little filling here, a little filling there. And the day that he ran up here, he never even had LASIK, tongue tie, nothing, dropped a D-bit in his mouth, and yippee-ki-yay, that was it, you know. So he was just basically a freak, you know. It's too bad he didn't go, like, to Europe or something like that, where there was some give in the ground over there, and he would have avoided all those problems. He might have rewrote history on the racetrack, but, you know, he had a 7-month career. You know, he had a hell of a career, but it was only 7 months. He ran from March at Gulfstream. He didn't run. He was bought, actually, in September, right after he won for us. And he didn't run until following March at Gulfstream. And then, you know, he reeled off the Florida Derby, the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness, you know, and he had like a good 7-month career. But by the time he won that turf race, they put him back on the turf. Monmouth rode a race for him over there. And he was pretty much finished by then, you know. When your feet go, everything else starts to go, your back, your ankles. And so they, you know, unfortunately, that's what happened. His feet started to get quarter cracks, and they held him together for all those big events, but it took its toll.
Yeah, he was an amazing horse, and, you know.
Yeah, he was real, real, real fast. I saw the interesting, you know, when you look back, I saw Rick the day that he won the A other day, and he said, "Babe, the horse is doing great, babe." but they brought me the wrong rider. You know, he had something against the Sormo. He was one of those free running type of horses like Seattle Slow. You know, he didn't want to be taken hold of or gagged down or anything like that, which proved to be fatal in the Belmont. He got in a little bit of traffic and he took a hold of him two or three times in a row, and the horse just lost all kind of interest. So, but that was his take on it. Even before he ever started, he brought me the wrong rider, babe.
Unreal.
But, you know, sometimes, you know, the people that own the horses, they want to step in and you know, you see it all after you train for a while. Some of the cockamamie ideas that people come up with at the last minute, they defy common sense. But, you know, like Woody Stevens said, the horse is 90% of it. You just stay out of their way.
Yeah, keep them happy. Keep them in the clear if you're a jockey, and just let them do their thing. That's we talk about it all the time. And by the way, we're talking with trainer Patrick Reynolds here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Pat, for you, sitting there at home watching the Kentucky Derby, knowing that you got his career started, what was that like watching Big Brown do his thing in the Derby?
Well, I'll tell you, the Derby was kind of like, looked like he had to win it. So, of course, I was disappointed. You know, I should say that, you know, Paul Papa, he takes care of everybody. So, and I still had a stable for him. It wasn't like he dropped me or anything like that.
Yep.
I had a nice filly for him, Backseat Rhythm, and she won the Garden City at Belmont, and she won the Lake Placid up here in Grade Two at Saratoga, and then she got beat a length in the Queen Elizabeth at Keeneland in the late fall, and then she was sold at auction. But she earned $800,000 as well. So it wasn't like I didn't. And I had a nice horse called Fearless Vision for him. He was a small stake winner. And a horse called Sicosity. And he won two Grade Threes for us. He was sold to the Arabs. There's like those long races over there. So it wasn't like, you know, I was dead with the guy. But sitting there watching the horse that you kind of brought to the races, win the Kentucky Derby, yeah, there was mixed emotions. And then after the Preakness, I said to my wife, I said, this is going to be one hell of a footnote in history. You'll see that asterisk, formerly trained by Meathead Pat Reynolds after he went to Triple Crown. People say, who was Pat Reynolds? How did he let this one go? But, you know, the Belmont just wasn't, and, you know, something happened. And I think a horse that never won again ended up winning the Belmont for Nick Seale. Just one of those quirky things that can only happen in horse racing. You know, and there was a lot of excuses, but I looked at Big Brown on the horse path as they were leading him back, and I saw the connections, and they were all shaking their head, and nobody knew what happened, you know, other than he got in a jackpot, and he was not the kind of horse that you could interrupt his action. You had to let him roll. You know, you do all the handicapping in the world, and you can do all of the ifs and buts, but you take a horse like that, you just got to break good and let him go. I mean, look at the fit that Cordero made with Seattle Slough, and later on in Seattle Slough's career, he used to get him out of the gate and just guide him around. It looked like there wasn't even a man on the horse. It looked like it was part of the horse. So that's what you got to do. You got to understand. You know, you got to understand what they want and try to give it to them.
Yeah, some horses love that running free, and others need to be covered up when they're on the grass and make one run. Yeah. I mean, but that's what makes our job as trainers so interesting is trying to figure them out, because they can't tell you. You've got to figure them out first.
Yeah, we've got one over here, like kind of like that now. She's going to run in the risk-averse handicap over here on the 23rd of August. She was just claimed over here at Belmont. And she won a little starter allowance, you know, like those gimmick races, I call them. And then she made the quantum leap up into a other than against really nice three-year-old fillies. And she's the type of filly that kind of needs to be covered up to, you know, just to let go of the bridle and relax. But she drew the 12 post, and she was in the clear of the wide open spaces all the way. And she was fighting the rider for quite a while. That kid David Cohen was on it. He's got a little bit of intelligence, so he took her away from me. I took her a little wide down the backside, so she was laying second, but she was a little wide. And she made a bid and then held off like Fletcher, Chad Brown, Shook McGahee, and all that. So we're not blowing smoke. We got a real good shot. The risk averse is for straight three-year-old fillies. She's been doing great up here at Saratoga.
Pat, do you have a go-to jockey or jockeys when you want that big win? Is there somebody that you give a leg up to and you say, yeah, I feel pretty confident right now?
You know, I'd like to say yes, but, you know, the idea that you have a go-to jockey and then somebody else has go-to 50 horses in the barn, that's what they go to. You know, so, you know, between, you know, the agents, they know how to play. You know, the top four or five guys will tell you, name me on, but let's have a backup in place. I've had a ton of luck with Javier Castellano, and he used to ride that filly, the one that I had, Backseat Rhythm. I think it's from an AC/DC song, so that's where she got her name from. Javier had the touch with her. She was strictly a one-run filly. And Sean Bridgman used to ride Deep in Tom. A lot of guys were afraid of him because, you know, he had the foot thing going on a lot. I mean, you know, but Sean went over $1 million on him. So, you know, pretty much when you get those kind of horses, you try to get a guy that's going to stick with you. But, you know, in this day and age, you know, in the age of, I hate to say super trainer because it makes them sound like they're something special. They're the guys with a super amount of horses, really, is what, you know, they, for one reason or another, they position themselves to have 100. 200 horses, and that's a lot easier. The game is a lot easier when you can rotate like that. So, the top jocks are going to stick close to them. And then I've had some luck with Louis Saez, Richie Migliori when he was riding. You know, most of the guys that you're pretty sure are going to let the horse run in the first place.
You know, the game's changed quite a bit. You've been a trainer a long time, and in the old days, the agents seemed to be more loyal to a stable or a trainer, and they'd stick with you through thick and thin. But nowadays, it's just, you know, what price is your horse going to be?
Right, exactly. That's, you know, but like I say, the good ones, you know, the guys at the top, you know, you get, you know, Ron Anderson, the kid that handles Jose's book, Jimmy Riccio, and IRAD's agent, Steve Rushing. You know, you got the top four or five guys. They let you know where you stand. You're not, you know, there's not that much spinning at the draw where you get angry and want to kill somebody and all that. So you try to line up the best guy available. You know, like the old timers used to, you try to pick somebody that's riding good now. You know, if you have somebody you want to give a shot to or something like that, it's a different story. But when you're trying to, up here, everybody wants the same five guys. So it's difficult. And then you do end up, you know, they spin you around a little bit. But at least, you know, if you can see it coming, you're okay.
Trainer.
You usually have a backup, you know. And once again, they say that, you know, the jocks, you know, it doesn't really matter. But you see up here what some of these guys are just, you know, the kid I read, he's just consistent as can be. Jose's, you know, these are young guys too. They've made their mark in the game in just a few short years. And then Rosario's writing great. Castellano writes great all the time. And you go right on down the line, and they just, you know, Florent Giroux, he doesn't ride that many, but he's a fantastic rider. You got the best of the best up here. You know, I'm probably, if I can win two by the time I get out of here, I'll be thrilled.
Yeah, there you go. Talking with trainer Patrick Reynolds on Trainer Talk, presented by Phase-It Tipton. Patrick, about 2 minutes or so before we have to get to our commercial break, but I want to go back to a name that you mentioned earlier, the filly Backseat Rhythm for Paul Pompa Jr. You know, our first Breeders' Cup that we ever broadcast on HRN was at Monmouth Park in 2007, and Backseat Rhythm ran in the Juvenile Fillies that year. She was third behind champion Indian Blessing and Proud Spell. A pretty salty group there, huh?
Right, right. Now, that was, she had broke a maiden on the turf, and then we decided to run her in the Frisette, you know, just because if you get some points, then you get invited to the, you have enough to go to the Breeders' Cup. And, you know, that's the epitome of horse racing at the end of the year, and she was doing great. She always did favor the turf, but she actually ran second in the Frisette. She was cutting into Indian Blessing's margin at the end, and she wanted to stay a route of ground. So we took a shot, and we went over to the Breeders' Cup. Of course, it was pouring down rain there, and she slipped and fell on her face in the beginning of the race. Coming out of the gate, she went right on her face and was last. So I don't know how Javier navigated that trip, but turning for home, she was second, once again, running after Indian Blessing. I said, oh, boy, here we go, the super filly. But it took its toll on her, and she finished the Proud Spell, edged her out for second. But it was a good race, and we were happy to get it back in one piece because the track was, it was horrible that day. It rained, you know, it rained like 2 inches or something like that. It was horrible.
Yeah, I got pretty wet. I was in the paddock standing under a tree.
Yeah, no, it was just one of those things. It was, you know, and actually it wasn't a bad Breeders' Cup. There was of course, the turf races were, you know, were a toss-up after that. I don't know, you know, I think Wesley Wood won the juvenile turf for the boys. But, you know, it's hard. When it's yielding or soft or boggy, it's very hard to get a line on horses in the U.S. But all the dirt races, I think Curlin won the big one that day. He ran as strong a Breeders' Cup as I've ever seen. So,
yeah.
It was a pretty good day.
Yeah, well, Backseat Rhythm would go on and win 5 races in that career. She would earn over $840,000. So she did quite well for herself, and she was pretty darn good. Just hooked a couple of monsters there with those two top fillies. But
yeah, well, that's when the monsters are lurking. They're at Saratoga. They're at the Breeders' Cup. You know, when you get to that level, which is really the level that, you know, that I want to try to get to again, that's, you know, that's where the money is, and you know, you get the nice owners and nice horses, and it's a little different at that level. I mean, the claiming game is fine, but you can't, you have to have a good runner in the barn.
Yeah, you do.
Some of those fillies that we had, and a couple of other horses, like the one horse, Zacosity, and he was a decent grade 3 horse, and the Arabs bought him and brought him over to Saudi Arabia, so those 2 mile races, and they gave a real good piece of money for him. So when you get up to that area, you know, you get up to that division where you're winning greater stakes, you got a chance to sell a horse, you know. And most people that I know need the money, so we usually sell.
Yeah, that's what the game's all about. He's Patrick Reynolds. He's our guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. We're going to step away for a short commercial break. We will come back and we'll talk more with Patrick. We'll tell you about the time in his life when things weren't always quite so good. That's next on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. On November 4th, let your stars shine their brightest under the Phasic Tipton November Sale Spotlight. Poised to attract the bids of the world's leading buyers, no other sale packs as much thrill and excitement into one single session. The November sale was stronger than ever in 2017, with record gains, as sellers realized top prices for their prized fillies, broodmares, and weanlings. Nominate now, the Phasic Tipton November Sale, November 4th in Lexington, Kentucky. Learn more at phasicnovember.com.
Bloom Racing.
Sky Diamonds takes the lead. Sky Diamonds to win, going away.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Midnight Bizou with another assertive final furlong. The top filly of the meet deservedly wins the Grade 1 Santa Anita Oaks.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at BloomRacing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Rossomayan, what a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm. Dedicated to the dream.
Millridge has a long history of raising and selling racehorses. Future Millridge stallion Oscar Performance broke a 20-year-old track record, winning the Grade 3 Poker and a mile on the turf at Belmont Park. This year's Millridge consignment at the Fasic Tipton Saratoga sale offers three quality yearling fillies by top sires Carpe Diem, Tappet, and Curlin. Since 2005, Millridge has sold 58 yearlings at Saratoga, with 74% winners, 5% Grade 1 or Grade 2 winners. Stop by Barn 5 for inspection. Millridge, raising and selling racehorses.
Bakari Bloodstock is consistently among the top consigners at major sales. Recent stars include Grade 1 winner Salty.
Here comes Salty down inside to grab the lead, and Salty has won it.
Bakari Bloodstock is offering four selected yearlings at this year's Fasic Tipton Saratoga sale by top sires Pioneer of the Nile, Bernardini, Honor Code, and Curlin, with hip number 161, a half-brother to Grade 2 winner Appealing Tail. Visit Bakari Bloodstock in Barn 2 at Fasic Tipton Saratoga.
Discover the difference with Hidden Brook Racing Partnerships. With 83% winners, 17% stakes winners, and 17% graded stakes runners from horses purchased, Hidden Brook partners have enjoyed success at the highest levels. From modest opportunities, Hidden Brook has campaigned a champion, 8 stakes winners, 3 graded stakes winners, and 8 graded stakes horses. In 2018, the partnerships have achieved 29% wins, with 46% of their starters finishing in the money. Discover the difference by visiting HiddenBrookFarmKY.com. I'm here with Dr. Jim Chiappetta of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, exactly how do the Flair strips work?
Mike, remember that a horse only breathes through its nose when it's running. About 50% of the resistance to getting the oxygen through the nose and into the lungs is at the nasal passages. They're the narrowest part of the upper airway, and that's where Flair strips work. The strips are proven to help prevent the nasal passages from collapsing, so horses breathe easier and get the oxygen they need more efficiently.
Learn more at flarestrips.com/learn. Denali Stud, led by 2015 Farm Manager of the Year Gary Bush, and Donnie Snellings, regarded as one of the best yearling managers in Kentucky. In recent years, Denali has raised Grade 1 standouts Animal Kingdom, Tapprit, Her Eminency, and Hawkish, while consigning Grade 1 winners Constellation, V.E. Day, and Bolt Doro. Consistently a top 5 consigner, Denali has sold a $1 million horse at the Saratoga sale 3 years running, and the sale topper in 2 of those years. Denali Stud, a proud tradition of attention to detail and raising and selling Saturday afternoon horses.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
As the field turns for home at the top of the stretch, and it is Big Brown who rolls open now to a three-length lead. Eight Bells is second, recapture the glory. It's third, Tail of the County is fourth, and the final furlong of the Kentucky Derby, and it's going to be Big Brown bounding home to a convincing win in the Run for the Roses. It is Big Brown by 5 on the wire. The filly, 8 Bells, was second. Dennis of Cork came from 20th to be third under the line. And Tail of the County was fourth. There's the Derby winner, Big Brown, and he delivered today.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. The great Tom Durkin with the call of the Kentucky Derby victory by Big Brown in 2008. He would go on and win the Preakness Stakes before coming up, well, inexplicably short in the Belmont Stakes. And Big Brown, a horse that was trained at that time by Rick Dutrow, started his career with our special guest tonight, Patrick Reynolds.
And he trained him as a two-year-old, trained him to break his maiden, and you heard that story in the first half of the program. If you did miss any portion of the show, all you have to do is head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out a podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows. Listen at your leisure at horseracingradio.net. Mike Penna, Jude Feld, that's Baron and Pontiff in our Jimmy John's of Lexington broadcast studios. And Patrick back with us now for the second half of Trainer Talk. Patrick, those days of Big Brown and Peeping Tom, some of the stories we talked about in the first half of the show, those were some of the high points. But there was a point in your life and in your career where things always weren't so rosy. And I read a quote when I was getting ready for the show that said, when you said, "I always knew how to train horses, but I didn't know how to train myself." Tell us what was going on then and somewhere around the mid-80s.
I guess... you know, what had happened when I was younger, you know, being a product of the 60s, there was always, you know, alcohol and drugs around. And I guess I had, it kind of got to me, you know, kind of got into the chronic stages where I could no longer pass it off. Like, well, you know, I like to party, you know, that kind of stuff, because it starts to interfere with your attitude and dealing with owners and then showing up at the barn. Then it was a problem, but, it took me a while to recognize it, and then after you recognize it, then you got to do something about it. So, and that entailed, you know, going for help. You know, I don't know too many people and I know some tough guys too. And you know, I'm no lightweight myself, but you usually got to go and go hang with other people that have done their best to live clean. You know, and that's what I ended up doing. And today I'm 100% clean. Don't drink, don't drug, don't smoke, don't do anything. So I'm like a real boring guy now. But, you know, I made up for it. They asked me in a restaurant, "Oh, you don't want to have a drink? You don't have a drink? You don't what? You don't like to drink?" I'm like, "You don't like your restaurant?" You know. So I can get you know, it doesn't never got any better, no matter. You know, and it wasn't much of a moderation thing. I just went to the extreme and, you know, used the excuse, "Well, you know, I work 7 days, I'm a racetracker," and all the rest of that stuff. But, you know, I started to realize that all the people around me that probably didn't do two-thirds of what I did were getting knocked off, and we were getting sick, and we were getting in trouble. I just started to explore different ways to try to get better. And I joined a program here and a program there. Never gave it a full go, but then finally I had to. And NYRA had a thing going on here, like they have the Winner's Circle out there in California. They have similar stuff over here for the employees and whatnot. But I think you just can't join part time. You know, I know there's been various, you know, stories in the last couple of years, guys that have gone in and out, but you have to make a commitment and kind of stick with it, because it's just it's a lifestyle change, you know. And I don't want to get too psychiatric, but you know, now it's, you know, I guess that was a way of trying to handle my emotions when I was younger, you know. And now that I know, like Maya Angelou said, now that I know better, I do better. So. But the main thing was I couldn't do it alone.
Yeah, well, kudos to you for facing that and for overcoming that addiction, Pat. A really great story there. It actually led to you voluntarily giving up your trainer's license at one point, somewhere around, what, 1985 or 1986? Is that right?
Yeah, I took a sabbatical. I had to take a break and whatnot. I never really got ruled off or anything like that. I never did anything crazy on the backstretch, but you know, and when I was done, you know, with the track and with the day's work over there, go to a bar, and then, you know, at 3:30 in the morning when they closed, I was like, "Where's everybody going? Don't you know there's a thing called after hours?" You know, so on around those times, it was pretty, you know, pretty bad, and I took it upon myself just to leave and try to, you know, get a handle on it.
Yeah,
I'm glad I did, and I know for what it is, you know. It's all, and you see it around every day over here, and you know, you'd like to lend a helping hand, but you can't really help anybody until they come and ask for it, you know.
Yeah, that's.
I know nobody could get to me until I was ready.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about the racetrack too. There's always a party going on. There's always dinners with clients and all that stuff. And so it really kind of lends itself to that type of lifestyle. And you know, you made a joke about you're a boring guy now, but sometimes sometimes you know people don't understand why you got to get home, go to bed, and do your thing, and it really can be difficult to deal with.
Yeah, well, we shut the door on that part of my life, but you know they say you have to remember where you come from, and I certainly do. But up here, there's that allure. You know, you go to a party or an event or something like that, and you see somebody start out. And they say they a little drink with the straw and the banana sticking out of it, and the orange, and they're having a good time, and you know, you say, oh, geez, it'd be nice to have a couple of those. And then 3 hours later, you know, someone is carrying to their car and all of that. So it's, you know, I know for what it is. You know, I know what it'll do to me. So I just, you know, I stay away. But I say people, places, and things. So, and, you know, Saratoga can be all of that. But it's not, it's kind of like a non-issue. I'm up here. You know, I like the idea of, you know, beating up on the big guys. And I've got to. Brought a nice filly up here, and hopefully we can do the same thing that I did with, you know, Peeping Tom, and I had a horse called Spooky Mulder at one point. You know, I've had some good animals, and that's all it takes. Get a good horse, keep him in good shape, and then you might upset the apple cart over here, and you know, because for once I can send those guys home talking to themselves. How did this horse ever beat me today? You know, and that's the enjoyment I get. That's the satisfaction. Out of the business now. The guy that I have now, I trained for him once before, and you know, we parted on good terms. His name is Bob Amendola. He's got a big fence company on Long Island, and done a lot of had Alan Iwinski and Butch Lenzini. You know, Butch had a tough time himself, ended up dying, and Bob and him won a lot of races together, and he's had as much as 15, 16 horses at a time. He's had some stake horses, so, you know, he claimed 7, 8 horses over here, and he's going to fill up the barn a little bit, and, you know, no telling what can happen then, because if you claim enough horses for 50 and 60,000, you're going to get a stake horse in there sooner or later. So, he's not a small-time owner. He's a good owner, and he came back with an interest, and, you know, he's 75 now. He's an older cat, so he came back with the interest of trying to do some good, you know. So we're both kind of in the stretch run of our lives, and figure on, you know, try to win some big races.
Trainer Patrick Reynolds, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Pat, when you did step away from the game that first time in '86, you stayed away for about 4 years or so. You came back as an assistant trainer to our good friend who is now down at Gulfstream, Billy Badgett. And that was a time when Billy had things rolling. He had Hall of Famer Gopher Wand in the barn. Tell us a little bit about coming back and working with Billy.
Well, you know, Billy was kind of, Billy's a different person, actually, when he's, you know, when he's your friend and when he's your employer. So he's, you know, he's got a hard line to him. He takes it real serious. And he comes from the Woody Stevens school. So everything was his way or the highway. And, you know, having trained horses, I could understand that. So I didn't really come back as an assistant to Billy. He had like 3 or 4 guys that couldn't handle him. And he said, geez, I can't take this guy. I can't take this guy. So he ended up going through like 3 or 4 guys in a row. And then he looked down the shed row one day, and I think I might have been walking hots and, you know, helping out like a foreman setting feed. He just looked over. He said, hey, take over. He said, these guys can't handle me. Take over. So I said, okay, I'll give it a shot. So I was with him the better part of a year, and then got along, never really had an, and, you know, it was all day. You know, it was like that Kentucky hard boot stuff. It was all day. It was, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning till 6:30, 7 at night. And, you know, having trained on my own every once in a while, got a little out of hand. You know, you question. But, you know, when you know, you don't question a guy you work for. He had his own way of doing things. And in the spring, his dad called from Saratoga, and he said, I'm sending up the best filly you've ever seen. So she's up here at Saratoga. Me, I pin-fired a little splint. She's 100% now. And sent her down, and she was a big raw-bone, lanky type of filly with, you know, power everywhere, you know, big big shoulder, big butt, just really well put together, and had an attitude like, you know, nothing bothered her. So, and built like a colt and acted like a colt. Acted like an old gelding, really. She just, you know, moseyed around, did whatever you wanted her to do, and that was his big break right there. And it got him going pretty good, and you know, I was able to get my legs back under me. I think I worked for Murray Garin after that, or somebody like that. And ended up getting a couple of horses here and there. Ended up buying a horse from Billy and August Belmont after that, and started training again. But I'm still friends with Billy, and thank God he got that, you know, that job down there. It worked out well on both ends. He's doing a great job for the Stronach group. So I'm sure he works just like the way that he used to work then, from sun up till sundown.
No question.
Yeah.
He's the first guy you see there in the morning, and the last guy you see on your way out.
Yeah, no, when he's business, he takes a no-nonsense approach, which is what you have to do. But like I say, you sit around with him and socialize, it's two different people. But, that's how it ended up. I went back to work for a friend, and about 4 months later, he went through probably three, four different guys, and he said, hey, take over. I said, okay. So I gave it a shot. It worked out. And then, you know, when I left on good terms and had my eye on getting my own horses again. So it's, the main thing is now, the owners are under the impression that only a handful of guys can train a horse, you know, and of course, we all know that's not so. And I think after they go with these super trainers, when they call up, they don't have to say, how's my horse? They have to say, where's my horse? You know, because they could be everybody wants to be at Saratoga, but you'll see a lot of these horses come in from Monmouth and back at Belmont. They just don't have enough stalls here to accommodate everybody. But, you know, because they win so many big races, that the big owners figure that, well, maybe I'll be the next guy that wins the Preakness. And, when money's no object at the sales and whatnot, they just keep feeding the fantastic horses. I mean, you know, not that they don't deserve them, and Chad has positioned himself into a really, really good spot, and he's a very patient horseman. But, you know, some of the Todd Pletcher horses, it's like numbers, you know. It's just, they keep, when one gets hurt, it goes back to the farm, and another one comes in. So that makes the game a lot easier.
Yeah, you have a tremendous pool to choose from. But, you know, it's always puzzling to me, because most wealthy people, they like attention. And I think sometimes they get lost in the shuffle in some of those big barns. It'd be better for them to have somebody that they could, you know, talk to every day and discuss their horses, and they'd have more fun.
Yeah, no question about that. But then again, the age of the super trainer has brought the age of the agent, the guy that's a go-between the trainer and the owner, and he's got the sheets, and he's got the racing form, and he's got all the baloney to feed the guys to keep them going. The game's changed a lot, you know. From their perspective, it's understandable. If you had a promise to have an owner give you 25 good horses every year, and you can put your hands on 25 a day, you can probably train 25. But that's about as much as I would want. But if you were assured to wake up every day to 25 horses, the game would be great. But the problem is, if a guy quits you and he's got 10, now you're down to 15. If you lose 5 in claiming races, now you're down to 10. If 3 gets sick, now you got 7. So you're worried about, you might become a has-been. So you start to take on all these clients from all over the place. You fill up 2 or 3 different barns. Now you got 75 horses. You got assistants at Monmouth and here and there, and it gets a little hairy. I mean, it's not for everybody. I have all the respect in the world for those guys with the organizational skills, but, you know, from the way I look at it, I would just like to train like 25 horses in one place where I could look at them, keep charts on them, and not have to take somebody else's word how they're doing. You know, Woody used to say, nothing like putting your hands on them.
Yeah.
He got out of a sick bed to try to get Devil's Bag to the Derby. He got out of a sick bed to go over to Churchill and feel his legs. So nothing like that, you know, that personal attention.
Yeah, Pat Reynolds with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. He is currently at Saratoga. He's had a really strong year in New York. If you missed any portion of this show, you can head back to our website, horseracingradio.net, and hear the entire program. It's been a lot of fun to hear Pat's story. Still plenty more to talk about here, Pat. The second time that you stepped away from the game was in 2010. You were away for about 15 months or so. What was happening in your life at that time that led you to make that decision?
Well, just kind of like lack of horses, and I split up with Pomper, and I got ill. So I, you know, rather than be one of these guys that comes out every day and has, you know, three cheap horses that he's rubbing himself, I just packed up my equipment and took a break. And nothing really crazy was going on. I just, like I said, the idea of coming in and, you know, in a pair of old boots, worn out jeans, thinking that something's going to materialize out of the woodwork, and bad horses make you look bad, and then people equate that with, you know, well, he must be a bum if he's got those kind of bum horses. So I didn't want to do that, so I gave him up and took it easy. I think in that interim, I had my mom died, and my wife's, both her parents died in that 15-16 month period. So they're really, every time I got ready to step back in, something would happen, and I just figured, well, you know what, I'll stay away. So I just, you know, came out handicapping here and there, and stayed around the track, but I wasn't actually actively training.
What brought you back?
Apple didn't need a CEO, and General Motors already had one. And, you know, this is kind of like all I know. You know, after you're in with the horses, you guys know, you get locked in. What are you going to do? You're going to become a repair watches or something somewhere? And it's just... And, you know, I thought, you know, about becoming an agent, but that's not for me, you know. And I don't like all that hopping around. One story turns into another. I'm a horse trainer. I'm a horseman. So I just, you know, I waited, and I got a little, you know, a little itchy, and then I came back. And, you know, this is, I guess, with this Bob Amendola, I've got a chance now. It's, you know, owners don't really... guy they met on a handshake or something, you know, someone they've known for 2 weeks, you know. But fortunately, Bob and I have a little history, and they sit on and they get together, they watch the head on, the side view, and son Michael helps them out with that. And common sense, I mean, if the game, you know, it common sense kind of accounts for a lot around the backstretch, but everybody's always worried about trying something new that they read in a book or they heard this guy's using that. They got 40. You know, they haven't changed a lot over the years. And I think there's probably, in veterinary science, we've had maybe the eye wrap, the shock wave, a throat operation. There's probably three or four real innovations that have taken place. But by and large, the game is pretty much the same. You know, if you're in the claiming business, unless you have some kind of hop or something or some kind of help, the game is governed by the magic claiming price. If a horse runs good for 25, he's probably worth 25 in my hands and in the next guy's hands until he goes bad. He's a 25 claimer. And so forth and so on. There's no real geniuses out here. Every once in a while, somebody makes a splash, but you know, you'll find out sooner or later they had a gimmick or they get caught doing something. They go, instead of being 39%, they go back to being 13% and 14%. So, you know, there's a few guys around now, but they, you know, that are, you know, high profile and all of that. But you know, by and large, it all comes out in the wash. They can't do much anymore. You know, they did away with, you know, for the sake of the horse, you can't pump them full of all the steroids and clenbuterol. And, you know, this circuit has been, you know, and it's been a, you know, concerted effort to try to watch out for the integrity of the game. And so a lot of horses don't get busted up. You know, here you still have to raise 125% off a claim. So a lot of people will give the horse the month off and run him back for the same money instead of trying it. So the horse does benefit from that, gets a month off, and you know, without all the injections and everything like that. And more of the guys that are winning are, you know, they use the horsemanship rather than drugs.
Yeah, that's important too. That the 25 raise. A lot of people want to do away with it, but I don't think it helps the game at all.
Well, there's, you know, the smaller owners seem to like it, and then as you get up to go up the ladder, you know, the bigger guys like to give that month off. You know what I mean? When you get right down to it, very few horses get freshened in this day and age. They get freshened when they get hurt. That's what happened. They got to take a chip out or a pin fire or splint. You never say, oh, you know, this horse, he's getting tired. Maybe we ought to put him on grass for the month of August and bring him back in October. Give him 60 days off or something. You just, the economics, you know, it's so damn expensive to train a horse in this day and age that the owners don't want to hear that. And they'll ask around and they'll say, oh, this guy's got something for what bother him. I'm going to go with him. So, yeah, you know, trainers are always worried about another guy coming up behind them and snapping up their owner. And, you know, the bill comes in every month, come hell or high water. A $3,000 training bill hits them right between the eyes. And if you've got a couple of seconds and a third, you know, if the horse is actively racing, it doesn't, you know, the placings and the action take the sting out of the training bill. But, you know, if a guy's got 8 or 10 horses, he's got to be not rich. He's got to be wealthy to sustain in this game unless he's running. So, you know, a lot of guys, they don't mind that, you know, claiming them. I think in most states you can run them back for the same unless you're one. I think then if you finish second, you can run back for the same money.
Pat, only a few minutes left before we have to wrap up the program. It's been a really enjoyable hour to kind of take a trip down memory lane with you and hear your story. Always like to wrap things up by asking trainers to tell us a little something about themselves that our listeners might not know. So any other hobbies, interests, anything else outside of horse racing that you enjoy doing?
Well, up here, I like to go fishing. You know, I'm a city boy. I'm from Flushing, but I always like to fish. And 9 times out of 10, I'll just take a rowboat out and go alone. And I've always played ball. Of course, I'm a little old for that now, but I was always a decent baseball player. Reading and films, I like to. You know, I like to have a lot of days after, you know, after hours, go hit a matinee film and sit there and take it in, you know. So you don't want me quoting Scarface or anything like that. I'll just say that, you know, that a couple of those genres that I always liked, you know, action films and all that. I like films. And as far as, you know, the books, you know, all the old classics. And then I like to read the New York Times and Car and Driver, Road and Track. Not much else. That was one of the things that stumped our governor from Alaska. They asked her, what do you like to read? She was like, a hummin', a hummin', a hummin'.
Sarah Palin?
Yeah, Sarah Palin. She said, oh, I like to read. I'm an avid reader. And they said, oh, well, what do you like to read? She didn't really have any answers for that. So, you know, and then, of course, once you get the entries and you get tomorrow's form, that's pretty much takes everything out of, you know, the wife will stay in one room. She'll be watching Say Yes to the Dress, and I'll be sitting there for 2 hours with the racing form. So
everybody's happy.
A match made in heaven.
We try to keep a decent balance like that. But, you know, truthfully, with the 7-day-a-week thing, it's hard to entertain some hobbies, but I think it's important to try to have some other interest. I kind of track my son's career. My son Patrick Jr., he's a hip hop guy. He's a producer and an A&R, and he works with Kanye West, and he's doing well for himself out in California. So we're always interested to hear from him. He just had a baby, so. You know, the back nine of my life, the stretch run of my life is okay. You know, whatever happened before happened. You know,
Pat, I have to tell you,
pretty satisfied.
I have to tell you, it's been a great, great hour here tonight, and we want to thank you for being with us. All the best in this stretch run of your life. I know you've got a few more furlongs left to go, my friend. So enjoy it.
I'm in good shape.
Yeah, enjoy it, my friend. Thanks for being with us. Like all of our guests who appear on the program, we'll send you a gift from one of our sponsors. It's Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We'll get those to you, and we'll hopefully catch up with you this weekend in Saratoga.
All right, great. You can see me in Bond 61.
Got it. Right. Pat Reynolds here on Trainer Talk, presented by Faces of the Way. absolute riot.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Great.
Great personality. Good guy. Yeah. Really good trainer, too.
Very
really,
good.
Really,
on
good
a
trainer.
Roll.
Paul Pompa Jr. said he's not just a trainer, he's a horseman. That's a great compliment.
Absolutely.
Yeah. For our producer, Lee Delapina, for Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. Check out the podcast at horseracingradio.net. Thanks for being with us.